this ruling class is dangerous, but also decadent, because they don't want to recognize the real problems of people, and they don't put any effort to try to solve them. So for instance, in these societies, homelessness is treated not as something that should be solved, but something that should be managed. If girls are dropping out of school, they treat that as something to be managed. But a real class that leads society to solve problems, not to manage them. And that's the difference between a decadent ruling class and a ruling class with vitality.
That's Vijay Prashad, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Vijay Prashad on the decline of the Global North. The Global North, or the West, is a group of countries led by the United States. In juxtaposition is the Global South, once called the Third World. In recent years, the Global North has undergone significant economic and political decline. The geopolitical landscape is shifting, thus opening new possibilities for Global South countries, particularly for China. A dramatic example of America's isolation was the UN vote on Palestinian membership. The vote was 143 in favor, 25 abstentions, and 9 against. Joining the U.S. no vote were such powerhouses as Nauru, Micronesia, and Palau. Increasingly, the U.S. position in the world is weakening. Its double standards, one set of rules for the master and his servants, and another set for everyone else, has not won Washington many friends in the Global South. Our guest today is Vijay Prashad. He's an internationally renowned historian and journalist. He's the director of Tricontinental and chief correspondent for Globetrotter. He's the author of many books, including Washington Bullets, CIA Coups and Assassinations. He spoke at Connolly Bookstore in Dublin, Ireland in late April 2024. And now, Vijay Prashad.
I want to share with you first a little bit about the nature of this war. You know, I've seen the bombing in Iraq. It was ruthless, brutal. The Yanks know how to bomb. The Yanks come in, they bomb the airport. Baghdad airport shut down. They bomb the power plants. They bomb the relay stations. They bomb water purification plants. They bomb the main highways. They shut the society down. In fact, when the Americans went to Ramadi and Fallujah, they just flattened the city. You know, when the Americans fought against ISIS in Mosul, they killed 30,000 civilians. 30,000, do you remember this? Maybe 2 million people have died in Iraq because of that illegal war. Those numbers are catastrophic. We've forgotten them. I went to Gaza after 2014. There were large parts of Gaza flattened. I thought, my God, this is the worst thing I've ever seen. And you know, it's important for you to know that Gaza isn't a refugee camp. It's not like one big slum. You know, people casually say open-air prison. Yes, it's an open-air prison. But it's an open-air prison with universities, with government buildings, with god-awful, but they exist, malls, with big roads, you know, the main Saladin Highway, and so on. It's a modern society. It's not just refugee camps. It's an error. Some people, I think, visualize Gaza as tents. No, there are apartment buildings and so on, and this becomes important for what I'm going to say to you now about that. You see, what the Israelis did in Gaza is they bombed everything. They bombed the power. They didn't have to bomb the airport. Do you know why they didn't bomb the airport in Gaza this time? Because they bombed the airport in 2002. They destroyed the Yasser Arafat airport in 2002. It's down near Rafah. Wrecked it. They bombed power plants, relay stations, water purification, everything that the Americans did in Iraq. And then they went further. They bombed all the bakeries. They bombed the fishing boats. I mean, it's interesting. They bombed all the ways in which the Palestinians used to eat fresh things. Fish and bread. There's no point bringing flour into Gaza because they destroyed the bakeries. They destroyed electricity supply. People can't cook. You know, you have to cook in barrels, burning wood and so on. This was a concerted attack to destroy the ability of people to live there. This was an earth-shattering attack on the Palestinian ability to live. And then worse than that, they bombed all the neighborhoods. They bombed and destroyed universities. In fact, they didn't just bomb universities from the air. They detonated buildings when they came in. You may have seen the Islamic University main building was possibly detonated. Why? Why destroy the university? They wanted to destroy modern life in Gaza. That's what they were doing. They first hit Gaza City, then they hit Khan Yunis, then they went south of Wadi Gaza, and they started smashing the edge of Rafah, where they are now. Okay, it's brutal. It's unbelievable. I mean, I've seen things in Libya, in Syria, in Iraq. I've never seen anything like this. It is madness what they're doing. It is a different level. And interesting, for the International Court of Justice, it wasn't enough just to talk about the evidence of what's there. You also had to have intent. You know, in terms of the UN Convention on Genocide, it's not just that you're trying to destroy a people by bombing them. You have to demonstrate intent. Well, that was easy. If you looked at the South African complaint, 29-page complaint, it's really still worth reading the South African complaint. There's a long section on the statements by high officials of the Israeli government on what they're doing. They say the most outrageous things. Human savages, they call them. They say the Gaza Nakba, Nakba means catastrophe, referring to 1948, the Nakba of 1948, expulsion of the Palestinians in Gaza Nakba, the second Nakba. We're going to not allow them to have water. We are not going to allow them to have food. By the way, saying that and then bombing bakeries, that itself is a war crime. 10% of the bombs dropped by the Israelis on Gaza are unexploded. That's the assumption of the United Nations. And the UN has now said it'll take 14 years to clear the unexploded ordnance in Gaza. 14 years. During that period, I don't know how many kids playing in here and there are going to be killed. This is exactly what happened in Vietnam. The Yanks dropped so much unexploded ordnance, and for years after, young Vietnamese children playing in the thing or peasants farming, dead, explosion. Yeah? That's what's going to happen. 37 million tons of rubble. I asked an engineer friend of mine, if you dumped all of that rubble into the Mediterranean, what would it produce? He said, probably produce another Gaza. But you can't dump it into the Mediterranean because it's toxic. And here's the other thing. There's 2.3 million people in Palestine, right? 2.3 million. I'm giving you all these facts. I know you're already in support of the Palestinians. That's not the case I'm making. I just want to establish a ton of facts because I think it's important to know this stuff. You know, it's not enough to say the Israelis are being genocidal. They're actually being genocidal. Like in general, we use these terms sometimes hyperbolic way, you know, genocidal. This is actually genocide. Andrew Gilmore, former deputy head of human rights at the United Nations. Andrew Gilmore on BBC Talk Night, normally filled with lies, that program, I agree. But in this case, Andrew Gilmore says the kill rate in Gaza is only matched by the kill rate in Rwanda 1994. Look, if you go to a war zone, 2.3 million people, huge number of children, there's two aspects of a war that nobody talks about. Outside we hear 35,000 plus dead, right? 7,000 to 8,000 missing. Out of those, probably 85% children. Those facts are there. But what we don't hear about war zones are two things. One is the noise. It's unbelievably loud. And that scars a generation of children. You know, if any of you have raised children or are raising children, you will know that you spend an unbelievable amount of time in your homes trying to maintain a certain silence so that the children go to sleep in peace. You read them a story, you give them a bath, you calm them down, you stroke their head, and then you send them peacefully into sleep. Hope they have a dream where you are the nice person. That's the way most children in the world should go to sleep. But for months on end, there is loud noise at night. I experienced this first in Iraq because everybody bombs at night. They don't bomb during the day. It's a stupid thing because it's from the time when you could evade ground-to-air fire, right? AK-AK fire. So you come in at night and bomb. I mean, when we're talking about Iraq or when you're talking about Palestine, there really isn't any ground-to-air fire. I mean, the Palestinians are not sitting there with a Bofors, you know, howitzer gun able to hit an Israeli plane. You know, at most they're firing an AK-47 or a Kalashnikov into the air. It's futile. It's impossible to hit a plane like that. So I don't know why they bomb at night. It's a habit or whatever, but they still come at night. Loud noise at night. Children are just scarred for an entire generation. But it's not just the noise. It's the toxins. Again, you see on Instagram or whatever, you see images, yeah, of an Israeli plane going and a building collapsing, right? And you say, wow, how many people died in there? Forget the people who died in there. Modern buildings are made of all the worst industrial glues. There are all kinds of toxins in everything in construction. When you blow up a building, all that stuff goes into the air. So 2.3 million people are breathing in these heavy metals, toxins of all kinds. They're going to suffer for a long time. I know that in Ramadi General Hospital, because of the use of depleted uranium, generation of kids was born with all kinds of deformities after the United States used depleted uranium. But even in places like Mosul and Basra and places, you saw birth defects. They may not have used depleted uranium, but they were bombing modern buildings. So people are breathing in these toxins. That stuff impacts a generation, okay? So this war, if it stops tomorrow, the death is going to continue from this for a very long time. Unexploded ordnance, people with lung diseases, different kind of ailments and so on, and children traumatized, for entire generation of children traumatized. I mean, in Jerusalem, I visited a school about 6-7 years ago. In fact, the person who took me to that school is now herself arrested, Nadira Shalob Kavorkian. She's a professor at Hebrew University. Children draw all kinds of things. One of the things they were drawing were clowns. All the children's clowns were crying. And they asked, why are your clowns crying? And they said, Palestinian clowns cry. I thought that was a very powerful line. Palestinian clowns cry. These children are being traumatized, generation upon generation. Now maybe 4 generations, 5 generations of Palestinians. That's the war that's happening. You know, that's what it really is all about. It's not just the number of dead. It's the character of the war. It's so different from other wars. Even the battle going on in the Democratic Republic of Congo, near Goma and so on, it's not like this. I mean, yes, M23 rebels are coming in from maybe Rwanda or crossing the Ugandan border, but they don't have air support, not like this. They're not coming in and just blasting entire neighborhoods. It's terrifying. They're not drones flying all over, just firing at people as they walk down the street. This is terrible. And it's just happening. And the thing everybody sees is that almost all the governments of the global north are fully backing this. I mean, the German government has been the most disgusting of them all. Frankly, Germany should introspect about its own history. Anti-Semitism is not an Arab problem. It's not an Asian problem. It's a European problem. Europeans need to deal with their own problems. They can't outsource it and blame other people who are standing up for their own rights for being anti-Semitic. It's insane. There was a time when people used to accuse me of anti-Semitism. I used to feel scared. Now I just feel it's ridiculous. You know, just stop it. You know, there's nothing anti-Semitic about anything I'm saying. It's stupid. Stop doing this. But these governments can't help it. They just can't help it. They continue to back Israel fully. And Israel knows that these governments aren't going to shift at all. You know, but that is what's really interesting. The fact that these governments can't move means that, A, the populations in these societies have become very restive, very angry. What's happening in the United States now is interesting. These tens of thousands of students who are just refusing to be scared, building tent cities, confronting the police, and what do the administrators do? And by the way, it's not just the students, it's their teachers as well who are coming out there. What do the administrators do? The administrators behave like their governments. They send in the police departments. They make mass arrests. I mean, the credibility of whether it's Olaf Scholz or Joe Biden or these presidents of different US colleges, their credibility is getting shredded. They don't have any credibility. I mean, how can Olaf Scholz be credible? And what's interesting about that credibility question is the credibility was first questioned in the South. I found that very interesting. And you remember when South Africa first took Palestine to the International Criminal Court? Does anybody remember when that was? It was in 2002, 22 years ago. South Africa took Palestine to the criminal court based on a complaint that the wall they were building around the West Bank was a wall that was going to facilitate apartheid. It's a very interesting case they brought, and they won that case, which is why it's technically correct to call that wall around the West Bank an apartheid wall. Israel is a party to the Oslo Accords, signed in 1994, establishes the Palestinian Authority. The Oslo Accords establishes the reality of a state of Palestine, which was to be the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza. If you read the Oslo Accords, it very clearly says that the Palestinians need to have safe passage between these three areas. So if you are a Palestinian in Gaza, you have to be able to go freely to East Jerusalem or the West Bank. Almost the day after they signed the Oslo Accords, the Israelis violated them. They didn't allow Palestinians to move out of these three enclaves. They simply started garrotting them, hemming them in, and then seizing the land, particularly in the West Bank and in East Jerusalem, but also in Gaza. You remember the settlement building in Gaza that took place before the election in 2005 and then the subsequent Israeli withdrawal. South Africans had the guts to do this in 2002, when the world situation was different. If you remember 2002, the Yanks were getting ready to go to war against Iraq. Million people in the United States marched on the street. Millions more in Europe and in the Arab world and so on said no war in Iraq. The United Nations Security Council refused to give a resolution for that war. But the United States went ahead in 2003 with the shock and awe campaign, March 2003, smashed Iraq, right? It's in that period that the South Africans, God knows where they got the confidence, went to the ICJ to say this wall is not correct. And that actually comes from the history of the anti-apartheid struggle. That's the real resilience of the South African move in 2002. But this is different. Between 2002 and 2023-24, there have been about 10 direct bombings of Gaza. Enormously monumental bombings. 2014, in just a few weeks, the Israelis killed 3,000 Palestinians. Bam! I thought there can't be a worse war than that. Nobody said a word. There's been silence right through this. You know, massacre in Jenin, the young children arrested. I was in the West Bank outside Ramallah in a refugee camp. I gave a talk to a whole bunch of young Palestinians. They wanted to know about the strategy of the Indian Revolution. serious. These young kids invited me to what was called the Edward Said Hall to talk about the strategy of the Indian Revolution. I was like, this is bizarre. So I was talking to them about what is the strategy, the People's Democratic State has to blah, 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 all this stuff. At the end, these young kids, 16, 17 years old from the camps, come in and they said, we don't have the time for all this strategy. We need to strike. We need to fight them. It's a military struggle. I was like, guys, take it easy. You need a strategy, otherwise you'll just all get killed by the Israelis. This is the time when young kids would rush against the police or a military officer and get shot. Or sometimes they didn't even rush. They were just getting shot at checkpoints. It's like, don't do that, guys. That was the mood right through. Desolation, desperation, hopelessness, complete, utter hopelessness. Nobody anywhere in the world was standing with them to say, hey, Israel, you can't bomb like this. You know, I mean, 2008, 2009, 2010, 2012, 2014, punctual bombing of Gaza. There was no complaint from any country. But this time, South Africa goes to the ICJ with a criminal complaint, very strong complaint. When South Africa went to the ICJ, Germany came in and said that there is no genocide. Do you remember this? Germany came in. Germany, God, why are you poking your nose into this? The response to Germany doesn't come from anybody other than Namibia. And that struck me as fascinating. You know, Namibia used to be Southwest Africa. It was a German colony. It's governed by the Southwest African People's Organization, which was a National Liberation Front. But like many National Liberation Fronts, over the period of the Third World Debt Crisis, the fall of the Soviet Union, they basically became a neoliberal party. You know, the options for movement were limited. So SWAPO effectively became the party of privatization, attracting foreign direct investment, you know, all the buzzwords, austerity and so on. I thought, you know, that SWAPO man, that's their politics now. It's a bunch of guys in suits. They exchange their military fatigues for suits. They don't have the will to resist anything. They are basically managing this society now. I remember going to Indo, talking to people there. I was like, this is, where is the essence of your fight? You know, where is the fight that your guerrillas took in Quito Conivale alongside the Angolans, MPLA, and the Cubans against the South African forces? The great defeat of South Africa in 1987, that was a big blow against apartheid, when the Angolans, the Namibians, the Cubans, the South Africans defeated the South African racist military at Quito Conivale. What a great battle. Where did that go? You know, that was the feeling, like, what the hell? Germany comes in and says, it is not genocide. Can't do a very good German accent, but otherwise I would. It is not genocide. Just imagine, like a sort of Hegelian thing, that certainties of the German, you know, language. There's no ambiguity. It is not genocide. And then the Namibian president sends a statement out, which was remarkable. It was direct. Where did it come from? He says directly to the German people, you don't have the right to talk about what is or isn't genocide. It's because you've done a genocide. And, you know, most people who wouldn't know the history think that he's referring to the Holocaust. But he wasn't. He said, when you ruled Southwest Africa, 1904 to 1908, you conducted a genocide. You wiped out the Herero people and you wiped out the Nama people. You extinguished these people from the face of the earth. And you've never acknowledged it and you've never apologized for it. I mean, this is a niche area. Only a few surviving people of the Herero and Nama communities know about this. And historians. Nobody else, this is not widely known stuff, yeah? It's like a niche atrocity. And it happened in Southwest Africa. Come on, guys, how many of you knew about this? You know, one of you I know was nodding, but maybe two of you or whatever. It's a niche atrocity, right? There are mainstream atrocities, such as the Holocaust, and then there's niche atrocities, happen to be mostly on the African continent. So nobody cares. This is benefits of racism is you can forget all the atrocities on the African continent. It's a great benefit of racism. This guy didn't forget, and he said this to the Germans. This angered the Germans a lot, because after all, somehow they've been able to reconstruct themselves as the great people of democracy and human rights. It's incredible. You listen to German chancellors, Merkel, Schroeder. I mean, who made these guys like an authority on human rights? Like, guys, some of you were Nazis. And if not you, your parents or your grandparents were Nazis. Like, how can you lecture us on anything? You guys were the Nazis. We were not the Nazis. My family, my grandfather, fought in Italy as a bloody conscripted soldier against Italian fascists. We are not bloody fascists, man. Our people, my uncles died off the coast of Spain, being dragooned to go and fight in France. You think they even knew where the hell France was? They came from Punjab. A torpedo hit their ship off the coast of Spain. Before they fired a gun, they were dead. They came to fight the bloody Nazis, man. We are not Nazis, you're a Nazi. How can you talk about human rights? What about us talking about human rights? It's completely bizarre. You know, when I listen to like these guys, like now Olaf Scholz on the other hand, if I had a picture of six people, you wouldn't be able to pick him out. I really doubt that any of you know what Olaf Scholz looks like. Can anybody put their hands up with confidence? Really? I bet you if I bring five photographs in a lineup, a criminal lineup, you may not pick the exact Olaf Scholz. The Ersatz one, maybe. Who knows what these people look like? It's hard to not get Rishi Sunak. He's just, he has something criminal on his face. Impossible to miss that stupid, idiotic smile that he does, right? It's really bizarre, that smile. Like, Rishi, what's so funny, man? It's a funny face he's got. So, that was Namibia. You know, and then one country after the other. Nicaragua takes Germany to the ICJ. Bolivia supports the case. Venezuela makes strong statements. Colombia supports the case fully and so on. Not one global North country supported the case. Not one. It's very interesting just if you look at that itself. The peoples of these countries came out on the street. You can't go 5 meters in Ireland without bumping into a Palestinian flag. And then look at your prime minister. He said that fantastic line. I don't know where it came from. It came from all these flags, Palestinian flags in Ireland. The sentence he said in the US, that spelled his doom. I mean, I don't know why he resigned. I never really figured that out. But that was quite a statement. I listened to that and thought, wow, that's interesting. Another mediocre neoliberal politician says something heavy, but then a few days later, he's gone. Yeah? We are in a very interesting situation in the world. In a sense, already, there's been a great depletion of the power of the global north. But because of this war and then the war in Ukraine and the way in which the global north has operated in terms of both of them, there's been a subjective decline in legitimacy of these ruling classes in the north.
You're listening to Vijay Prashad, The Decline of the Global North. This is Independent Alternative Radio. To get copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. Again, that's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
India, governed by a far-right government, has had a very interesting reaction to both of these conflicts. And I think slightly misunderstood reaction. First, Ukraine. Jaishankar is the foreign minister of a far-right nutcase government, the Modi government. When the Ukraine war proceeded, Russian troops entered Ukraine, India was asked directly, why are you continuing to buy oil from the Russians? And Jaishankar's comment on this was very interesting. And it showed you the sophistication of the lack of legitimacy of the North. He said to a questioner in front of Antony Blinken, when he was asked, he said, look, I've studied this carefully. He said, the amount of oil India buys in a month, Europe buys from Russia in an afternoon. Think about it. That was his reaction. In other words, if you don't mind me saying so, that was his reaction to that question. He was then asked, why won't India join NATO Plus? One of the US Congress people said, we should allow India into NATO Plus. You know how they are magnanimous. We should allow India into NATO Plus. Jaishankar, the foreign minister of a right-wing government in the Global South, was asked about this magnanimous gesture from a US Congress person, and he responded saying, we don't believe in the NATO mindset. When I first heard that, I was surprised. We don't believe in the NATO mindset. Then, when this war began, you know, this far right-wing government has a very close link with the Israeli government. Very close link. Mr. Modi is very close to Mr. Netanyahu. But India has not backed this war. In fact, the official statements coming out of India replicate the statements coming out of China. The official statement is the following. We believe in the two-state solution. Now, I know people on the far left say the two-state solution is garbage, whatever. But I want you to be careful about what this means diplomatically. Basically, what the Indian and Chinese government are saying is we will never sanction the Israeli annexation of Gaza. That's what they mean by saying now the two-state solution cannot be touched. They are saying that the annexation of Gaza is off the table. It's a very important statement now. It doesn't mean they believe idiotically that the Swiss cheese of the West Bank can be converted tomorrow into a two-state solution. I don't think that's what it means at all. It means they are underlining the fact that they will not allow the Israelis to take over Gaza. So even India, far-right-wing government, in this moment, is unwilling to fully back the Israelis. That's interesting to me. What has made all this happen? In this last period, since 2006-2007, and that postcard I gave some of you has a link to the report that our institute did on hyper-imperialism, where you can see some of the empirical data on this. See, we argue that when the financial crisis took hold, triggered by the housing crisis in the US, it opened up what we call the Third Great Depression. So there have been, we argue, three world or global depressions in the modern era. The first global depression was triggered by the railway collapse in the United States, 1893. All three of these depressions were triggered by events in the US. So the first is the railway collapse, 1893. That depression lasted for not such a long period of time. Less than a decade. The second depression is triggered by the Wall Street collapse in 1929. And in fact, that depression lasts deep into World War II, which is an interesting thing because I'm of the view that there's no World War I and World War II. It's one long war with a halftime. The halftime lasts from 1919, roughly Versailles, till 1939. It's one long war because it's the same war, the same protagonists on either side. And they were fighting over the same inter-imperialist problem that they all faced. But still, that 1929 depression, the Second Great Depression, lasts well into the war because the war economy helps the recovery. And we argue that the Third Great Depression starts with the collapse of the US housing market 2006-07 and is actually ongoing even now. That you have some relief here and there, largely generated by the moves of monetary policy or commodity prices and so on. But the inflationary problems are ongoing. The problem of employment is ongoing. The move from basically some decent work to precarious work is helping these economies survive, but it's not improving the situation. There's an increased rise in precarious work and so on. So our argument is that in this period, during this long third Great Depression, which is ongoing, there's been a real move that particularly the economies of the global north have been making. A move that, in a sense, has trapped them. You see, the United States, which used to be a net exporter of capital, has since around then been a net importer of capital. Dollars are going back into the United States. Simply doesn't have the surplus to generate a development policy for the third world. No longer can the United States or European countries make big investments in the global south. It's just not happening. You know, they are not able to do it. Rather, they are using their reserves to build up their militaries. So in our study, we calculated that the US military budget annually isn't 900 billion as they claim, but 1.53 billion. And that if you add up the military budgets of the United States, the other NATO countries, and the NATO plus countries, Japan, Korea, and so on, it all accumulates to 75% of world military spending. So 75, 3 out of 4 US dollars, world military spending is spent by the NATO countries, NATO plus countries. China is responsible for 10% of world military spending. It's so interesting how the media constructs China as a threat. Russia is something like 3% of world military spending. These are defensive powers. There's only one dangerous military bloc in the world, and that's the one led by the United States, which includes Israel. I mean, this is a really dangerous military bloc. About 15 years ago, I remember writing an article saying that, you know, and Varoufakis was saying this at the same time, that one way to deal with the European unevenness of surplus and debt is to create a euro bond market, like the US Treasury bonds. So equalize the debt amongst European countries and start selling unified bonds for all European countries so that there's no unevenness between the countries. Yeah? Because Greece was going through a situation of debt. At the time, people just laughed at that. It's impossible. It's a dumb idea, as they often do, right? It's a terrible idea and so on. I don't know if you followed recently. Recently, it is the NATO crowd that has been talking about floating a European bond. But this time, not to alleviate debt pressure or to raise money for development within Europe, railways, you know, high-speed rail. Look at this island, okay? It's crazy. Today I discovered it takes 3.5 hours to drive between Belfast and Dublin, correct?
Yeah.
How many kilometers is it from Belfast to Dublin? 100 kilometers? Between Beijing and Shanghai, there's a high-speed rail that runs at 300 kilometers an hour. You should be able to get on a train in Dublin and get off in Belfast in 25 minutes. 20 minutes, maybe. Why are you driving 3.5 hours? You got a train, 20 minutes. You should have a train. It's crazy. You know, high-speed rail, you know, decent public services and so on. Why not float a bond for that? No. What are they talking about floating a bond for now? Building a new arms industry. Going over 2% of GDP on military spending, plus above that, subsidies to the arms companies. That's what the same kinds of people, European Central Bank, that scoffed at the idea of a Eurobond for development and to equalize the debt in the continent, they are now talking about, we need a Eurobond, but for war, not for peace. Europe, self-image, was supposed to be the project of peace. Okay, go back and read the Maastricht Treaty, first paragraph. It's a project of war today, right? I mean, look at this. We're going to have a Eurobond for war. So one point is that the global north has moved essentially from exporting capital for development through all kinds of instruments, including the Club of Paris and the Club of London and so on, to maintaining the capital to build up a military ensemble, enormous military. Yeah, dangerous, threatening military. The United States has 902 military bases. We in our study we have a list, 902, including a terminal at Accra International Airport, where a US soldier can just walk into the country, doesn't even have to show a passport. Their planes just land at this airport and they just walk through the terminal. I've never heard of this anywhere in my life. So on the one side, there's this massive buildup of a military, in a sense, projection. On the other side, while the global north has basically collapsed as a development project, yeah, its whole promise, post-war promise, from the Marshall Plan for Europe to development through the World Bank for the Third World, however bogus that was, it was still a promise. All of that has been locked up, closed, and now all of that development is coming from Asia. The Chinese BRICS and Belt and Road Project, Indian money in Africa, Nigerian money in Central Africa, Indonesian money, and so on. All of that stuff is coming from Asia. So the Namibians, for instance, who used to have to go to the IMF and beg for money, now get loans from the People's Bank of China or the New Development Bank. They are no longer beholden to the global north. The whole width of debt and debt relief is no longer applying to them. That's how the world is changing. That's how these countries are no longer feeling like they need to answer to the master. In fact, it's not subjective reasons that are changing the language. It's an objective shift. But it's an objective shift that we argue in our text that's not happening seamlessly. Because this imperialism of the North, which we call hyper-imperialism, just to give it the kinetic quality of this imperialism, this imperialism is, we argue, dangerous. 75% of military spending. Look at the way they bombed Iraq or how they destroyed Libya or now the destruction in Israel. It's important you don't see the destruction in Israel in isolation. Like how they destroyed Libya is extraordinary. And it's unremarked. The state is still not recovered. You know, institutions have just been destroyed. There are three governments in Libya. 22 and a half years after the NATO bombing. It's unfathomable. Or the way in which the government in the Democratic Republic of Congo cannot establish its territory, has lost control of large parts of the country, multinational corporations and their agents running riot. It's back to the days of Livingston and Stanley and so on. So on the one side, it's dangerous because they are ruthless with violence. Ruthless. And that's not just violence of bombing and so on. They're ruthless with the critics of violence. So for instance, my friend Ghassan Abu Sita arrives in Berlin Airport for the Palestine conference. A British Palestinian doctor, plastic surgeon, who was there in Gaza during the war, they deport him from the airport. And then Varoufakis, who, you know, is a radical, but he's not like off the limit radical. I mean, I would be happy to be deported, but not Giannis. You know, he's like a, he doesn't swear. And I think, you know, he's more distinguished looking than me at least. You know, Varoufakis is given a ban from Germany. Not only a ban, and by the way, he ran for the European Parliament from Germany in the last elections. He has a ban, so he can't enter Germany. He has a ban that he can't do a Zoom live in Germany. And he has a ban that he can't send a video to be broadcast in Germany. Most people have just the first ban. I had a 10-year ban from Saudi Arabia. That was great. But they didn't ban me from Zooming in or sending a video. But the second word we use for what's happening among the ruling classes of the global north is decadent. And I want to end with this point because, you see, I know
when you look across the Atlantic and you look at the miserable United States election, and you think, my God, it's a country of 300 million people, and they pick Biden versus Trump, like the rematch. I mean, I got Ali versus Foreman, the rematch, but that was worth it. You know, both Ali and Foreman were at their prime, somewhat. But this is a really terrible, this is like Ali 20 years later. It's appalling. I mean, it shouldn't be allowed. The first thing is, I know lots of people Biden's age who are completely lucid and clear. And I'm going to explain why I say that. This is not a question of age. He may have some illness or whatever, but this is not an age issue. I was with Atilio Borón, the great Argentinian Marxist, in Venezuela last week. Atilio Borón is sharp as a tack, same age as Biden. This is not about age. Trump is not specially insane. I mean, there are lots of crazy people in politics, right? There's nothing. But what's extraordinary is not their personality, Trump, or their age, Biden. What's extraordinary is like so many of the ruling class's products, they have no ideas. They have no project. They have no way to talk to people about solving the basic problems people are facing. Like in Ireland, basic problem, housing. I mean, I don't know how anybody rents an apartment in this city. You know, it's unfathomable. But these guys don't have any project. I mean project in the big sense. In fact, I would say that there has been a kind of intellectual collapse in the global north. I'm sorry to say this, but, and I don't know if any of you are university professors or whatever, but the work coming out of the universities has become a different kind of work. If you're a faculty member, you don't necessarily have the burden of answering questions in your society. I went to visit the US military bases in Hawaii, and I took, I don't know, like half an hour went to the local University of Hawaii bookshop. By the way, University of Hawaii was where they developed Agent Orange, which they used in Vietnam. There should be a sign. You know how now in the United States people say, we are on Algonquin land. It's a land recognition. I don't think you do this in Ireland. They do this where they killed all the native people. They kill them all and then they say, we are standing on their land. I gave a talk there at the university and I said, why do you do that? Why don't you also say, we are standing on the university that created Agent Orange and destroyed the Vietnamese people, you know? Because they feel good saying we are on occupied land. It makes them feel good, like they are doing something so generous to the people massacred. What about your complicity in wars today? Anyway, went to the university library. I was surprised at how the titles produced by the faculty seemed completely detached from the world. Narrow studies, esoteric topics, you know, there's like mass starvation out there. Where are the brains of our world today? You know, where is the German Hegel of today? Or the Jean-Paul Sartre? Are these societies producing intellectuals that raise the big questions of our time? The Bertrand Russells and, you know, whatever. I'm just naming these three because they come to mind, but there were many others. Bertrand Russell is a good example, actually. Russell was a technical philosopher, and yet he was worried about the bomb, about nuclear destruction. He was worried about poverty. He wrote with feeling for his society. You know, not just the technical work. He wrote with feeling for his society. And he intervened to try to elevate the public debate, including with politicians. We may think nothing of the Fabian society, the Fabian, I think nothing of them. It's a mediocre social democratic work. But yet, those intellectuals tried to intervene in the debates, the compelling debates of their time. I don't see that anymore. And if you don't have that, if you don't have that cultural intellectualism in a society, how can you expect your politicians to be anything but mediocre? Politicians don't grow in a vacuum. They are utterly mediocre. And I know people think, well, Xi Jinping is a dictator, but I read his speeches. Fascinating. Compelling reading. The guy is thinking about the problems of our time. And It may be that he doesn't write them himself. Who cares? None of them write their own speeches. The point is that that's what they are reading out. They're talking about the problems of our time, how to solve them. Isaac, who's running for election in Kerala, or Pinarayi Vijayan himself, the chief minister of Kerala, super interesting speeches. He engages with the problems of our time. You know, I'll give you an example, and I really will end with this one. During his first term as chief minister of Kerala, a report came in on his desk. And the report was about how girls of a certain age were dropping out of school. So the way we got the story from his speech was he read the report and he thought, well, why? The real issue is why. He sent his team off to investigate. They came back and they told him, the reason is that this is the public school system, not the private school system. Girls in public schools were dropping out. They came back and said, well, it's actually a very simple answer. The problem is that the moment girls start getting their periods, when they menstruate, they don't have the finances to buy, you know, sanitary napkins and things, so they don't come to school. And what happens is, when they drop out during their period, they often don't return to school later. They feel embarrassed or whatever. So the government had a serious discussion, and they said, well, the answer is simple. Girls are dropping out because of the lack of technology to deal with menstruation. Let's provide free sanitary napkins in the girls' bathrooms in school. That's what they started to do. But that was not enough. Then he gave a speech about it. He explained it. He came to the people as a teacher, in a way, that we had this data point. We discovered that this is the likely reason. This was the public policy solution, having these boxes of, say, and now we are going to monitor this to see, because no girl should lose education as a consequence of embarrassment for something which is perfectly biological, right? One example, it's a pretty good example, of, in a sense, taking a problem and raising it to philosophy, you understand, philosophy in the generic sense, and making it a moment for the whole culture to reflect on prejudices against women at a time of menstruation. This was, in a sense, an assault on patriarchy. But he did this in such a clever way. A leader. That's not this Olaf Scholz kind of thing. So, in other words, what I'm trying to say is this ruling class is dangerous, but also decadent, because they don't want to recognize the real problems of people, and they don't put any effort to try to solve them. So, for instance, in these societies, homelessness is treated not as something that should be solved, but something that should be managed. If girls are dropping out of school, they'll treat that as something to be managed. But a real class that leads society leads society to solve problems, not to manage them. And that's the difference between a decadent ruling class and a ruling class with vitality. And by ruling class, in the second sense, I don't mean it in terms of a bourgeoisie, I mean a class that leads a society. And with the example of Pinarayi Vijayan, he rules to solve problems, not to manage them, with vitality, in an intellectual sense. Explaining things to people, not administering things, telling people to shut up and so on. So, when we think of Israel and its destruction of the Palestinians, it's not just a situation of Israel. This is a much broader, slow, lingering decadence and danger that comes from the global north.
You were just listening to Vijay Prashad, The Decline of the Global North. He spoke in Dublin, Ireland in late April 2024. Vijay Prashad is an internationally renowned historian and journalist. He's the author of many books, including Washington Bullets, CIA Coups and Assassinations. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 38th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Chris Hedges, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, and Arundhati Roy. And we have a series of programs with Vijay Prashad. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Vijay Prashad, The Decline of the Global North, and for his book, Washington Bullets, CIA Coups and Assassinations, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with India's great sarod maestro, Ali Akbar Khan, playing Raga Marwa.